I've been living with this question for the last 20 years. It's been a pretty dark period, I can tell you. But I'm glad it's now finished. I'm negotiating with a publisher to get it actually published. But the department has always been very kind to me. That's the department of ACS. And I think I owe them something. And I want to especially thank Simon for being my sort of person to talk to. Although probably he never understood what I was talking about, at least some of the time I didn't myself. But anyway, it was quite a pleasure. Now I should be able to walk a little bit, and then it should change. You can see I have a three-legged argument, and I'll talk about China, I talk about artisanal knowledge, and I'll talk about the implications of that idea, of the idea that God is an architect, i.e. a mathematician. Now, to see the power of that idea, look at these four pictures. Three of them you should know. And probably the first one left at the top, you shouldn't. But you can see that this picture sort of translates to the other three. Now, the first one at the top, this one, is in the Österreichische Nationalbibliothek. It's Codex 2554 and dates from 1220. 30. It's from a memorialized Bible, so that's a highly decorated thing. It's been recently published in the same format as that Bible. It's quite different. I want to have it on the cover of the book, and then it looks like this, which is sort of the same. and Newton in front of the British Library, so this is here, has something to do with this chap over there, especially the maker of that picture. Should remind you of a Borges argument about the universe, which others call the library. And at the end of my talk, you should be able to understand why Borges is making the two equivalent. Now, my presentation is based on the 110,000 words manuscript. And I have about 30 minutes, max 40. So I need some reductions and scaling down. So what I'm going to do is basically give you a very rough outline of the whole thing. But at least I hope you will be able to see how the argument works. I'm going to give you the structure of the argument. I'll leave the details out. Now, who's Needham? Needham, this is about the age of 36, being born in 1900. That makes it always very easy to calculate how old he is. He made his name as a biochemist. He was a former master of Keyes. That was in the 60s. He's been a fellow of Keyes for all his life. He got a FRS for his work on biochemistry and he got an FBA for his work on the history of science in China. And he's one of the very few people who actually have both abbreviations to their name. I've got two questions here. I'll come back to those. And he published a huge series of volumes, generally known as Science and Civilization in China, and the whole project hinges on one particular question. Why did the scientific revolution not occur in China? As if it should have. And that's, of course, the whole thing. Now, why should it have happened anyway? Now, if we have a look at the two quotes I put up here, especially the second one, that's basically... The idea is that you have a huge amount of artisanal knowledge, and all of a sudden the idea is that should burst into scientific knowledge. Now, what's the argument behind that? Then we come to this chap. And when I started working on Zielsow's life, I didn't know the importance of it for the Needham question, although my interest in Zielsow was because I wanted to do something with Needham. This is a very traditional painting. That's another picture. So what Zielsow says is if you bring the brain and hand together, then all of a sudden you have science with some particular argument behind that. And that particular argument is the emergence of capitalism. So for Needham, the question then becomes, because this merger of artisans and intellectual scholars didn't happen, that's because the question then becomes, why didn't
capitalism emerge in China? Now, you can think about that in as long as you want, but you've got one negative question: why did something not happen, replaced by another one? So you really have to start wondering, what did be progress at all? Okay. I'll come back to that later on. I'm not going to talk about Chinese philosophy. It's the wrong term, but I'll use it anyway. So the Chinese are into wisdom, and their education is geared to achieving this. Now, model emulation is how it's done. And the model you have to emulate is a sage. The correct characters or graphs, as they are called, are up on the screen. Now, a sage is a divinely inspired and intuitively wise human being who hears, stress this, hears the way of heaven, the way of heaven, and develops an all-compassing understanding of it. He knows the hidden meaning of all things and lives accordingly. While modeling oneself after a sage, by attuning one's mind to that of the model that's to be emulated, well, that can only be done by that way one can become one with heaven. So the sage is an exemplar of promoting moral and spiritual cultivation. In other words, he's a consumptive model. In him, human nature is consumptively realized. That's another way of saying that the earnest seeker of Tao is also a devoted student of the sages. Now, for me, the important question is, how is this learning being done? First question to ask is learning the right way anyway? The right word anyway. Cultivation might be more appropriate. Pruning oneself might even be more appropriate. So the trouble is that familiarizing oneself with a topic is not about learning about it. That's when you do, when you study something, you acquire knowledge about it. But you have to sort of become one with a topic. Some academic knowledge, because it's propositional, isn't the right model to use here, then the question becomes, what is? And my suggestion is, well, after all, we're looking at, or some of us are looking at snooker at the time, World Championships, to take Ronnie O'Sullivan as your template. Now, the rocket, we all know, can play extremely well. And he's been once described as somebody who makes playing snooker look deceptively easy. And you can also say the same thing about some guy called Roger Federer playing tennis. And if you want various versions of that, well, basically go to the final of the Wales Championship lot this year. And you see how he beat Ding Yun. And you see what he means. Or if you see his short version of when he did this extremely quick break, the old point break, 1-4-7 break, in how many minutes? 5 or something like that? Incredible. Okay, that's my template. Now, you can only reach the level of play he's able to play if you can one with what he accomplishes. That's the ultimate point. The thing you have to do must come as a matter of course while going with the flow. And everybody will tell you, if they're in a sport, going with the flow means put this thing off. So don't think, just do it. Go. The moment you start thinking, you're gone. So you have to achieve what needs to be done, and it must come almost naturally, and also it becomes easy. Now, to reach that ultimate is needed to become a sage. Now, I can go on for quite a while now, but the idea is rather simple. Ronnie O'Sullivan is only achieving this stage, the sage, in a rather circumscribed section of living. And the idea of a sage is that you blow it up. That's why it's not just about playing snooker very well, it's about living your life very well.
That was Hurricane Dickens.
And the former champion of draughts, the checkers, this is Tom Sidewell, which is a Dutchman, by the way, but described the state of being as playing as checkers as God intended it. He made this remark sort of when John Lennon made a similar remark. Mm-hmm. And you can think about the enormous rounded course, but he's a thought of right, you know, sort of, he is right. Now, to put a more Chinese gloss on this, he was conversant with the ultimate principle of things as a sage. And reaching a knowledge of states of living well is what statehood requires. It requires one to submerge in this old persuasive unity of heaven and being able to live life according to the cosmic spell of considerations accordingly. Now the divine power of creation is called heaven, and the sage is ultimately able to intuitively comprehend this creative power because he has become one with it. Now becoming one with heaven is to achieve this ultimate fellowship of sympathetic unity requires a transformation of the mind, and that's how you learn to tune yourself to heaven and act accordingly. Now this transformation of the mind, to put it in less abstract terms, this cultivation and pruning of the person, edification of the person, is what model emulation is all about. Okay, now I hope I've lost you. Because that's the whole point of this. It's a classical anthropological trick. You immerse people in something which is completely foreign to get a feel of the distinction, how far away this Chinese idea of knowledge is from what we think that knowledge is. So the Sinetic civilization has a rather unique character, and it has its basic philosophical outlook. Outlook and philosophical are both objectionable terms, but I'll use them for didactic reasons for now. It's fundamentally different from the path taken by the West. And the difference between Tao versus Logos, way versus rational structure, that's in the book, I'm going to leave that out. Now let me take stock of what I've just said. What emerges from my perspective is that the indigenous Chinese conception of knowledge, this is the Z, is part and parcel of this idea of self-cultivation as a ceaseless process of inner illumination and self-transformation, a process that entails a transformative act upon oneself via an objectless awareness, intellectual intuition, and is directed at a communion with the way of heaven. Now this is a non-discursive enterprise that you achieve a comprehensive breakthrough, intellectual grasp of nature, of the world and things. It requires interfusion and identification of subjectivity of human and objectivity of things. The crucial idea here is that the Chinese construe life as an unending stream reaching in all directions into infinity. Okay, that being done, now to this part. From the very beginning, the new Nithan project was criticized from a particular perspective. And here is Hummel, who wrote actually two reviews of the first volume. This is the one in the American History Review. And the quote is rather simple: Nithan seems to forget something. And what I've just explained is why there is an argument about what Hummel says. Okay, so when I started to do some serious reading on China, it quickly became clear to me there is not the least reason to suppose for one moment that the scientific revolution was about to burst on the stage over there. And serious doubts were published right away. I've got another quote, which I didn't put on this slide, but so the Chinese historian of history of philosophy in China in 1922 addressed the same question Nita was trying to answer, and he did this in terms of, well, basically the Chinese are invested heavily in cultivation and geared their knowledge game to find good and happiness directly in the human mind. And you can see why I would agree with this. Okay. This is end of first leg, second leg, artisanal knowledge. The knowledge the Polynesian navigators, to take just one example, is by all accounts very much an embodied ritualized performance knowledge, and an attentive coping in the world which needs to be understood as a practice of skill. It's a way of going about things. Now, if I did my philosophy right, according to philosophers, the unit of scientific knowledge is a proposition. And a proposition is a well-articulated sentence which has a well-defined truth content. Now, if you try that model with this Polynesian knowledge, it gets you nowhere. and it got my whole project stuck for a very long time because I didn't know what to do next. So because artisanal knowledge is at once a form of knowledge and a form of practice, it's monistic. But propositions aren't one bit monistic, they're dualistic. So we have a problem. Now, perceptual experiences arises from applying rules to concepts or to putatively meaning collections of data gathered to a sensory receptor. That's basically central to this traditional empiricist view of perception. But if you look at the artisanal way of things, perceptions are never meaningless. They're always molded by previous ones and are immersions in our present perceptual environment. So information taken on by the senses is never meaningless, but always endowed with meaning. So instead of a dualistic split of subject and object, thought is instead, but at least that's what Ingold calls it, an organism person. It's not an exactly elegant way of putting it, but it gets you where you want. So the idea is that artisanal knowledge is absolutely different from propositional knowledge. We're still left with the question, what is it? This gets you to this. So I talked about the synaptic tradition in terms of learning. So I'll talk about artisanal knowledge in terms of learning. But we should all be anxious. You can't talk about artisanal knowledge unless you talk about how it's learned. So if I have to describe the kind of thickened cream that goes on a traditionally prepared Irish coffee, I'd rather show it to you instead of talking about it. Then if I show it, that sort of gets you to the point where you think, well, this is what I want. And if I have to talk about it, it gets you nowhere. So not only is showing it easier, I'm almost certainly much quicker, and I would be more confident that you would have grasped what I meant. Now, to the extent that practical tasks are made of strings of sensory motor tasks, this is a description of these sequences of actions, all learned largely by accretion on previous one, obviously difficult, but in the end, it gets you there. Okay, now I'll skip the text a little bit. And one of the things that's rather important in artisanal knowledge is actually you emerge into it, you learn it from outside to inside, you assign small tasks and slowly build on. And by being small tasks, I mean, for example, when I trained as a junior chef, I had to cut quite a lot of onions. And you think, why would you need to do that? Well, you need an amazing amount of onions cut up in a restaurant anyway. But the other thing, of course, is if you grasp something, what do you actually do? This is what you know. This is how you take it. And if you this is the way you cut up your onion, what happens? You cut yourself. So the one thing I had to learn is if I grasped the onion, I did it this way. So you learn it this way. So you put your knife always this way, so you can see these are to mine. And I can tell you, if you do it the wrong way, you bleed. Very heavily. So I was sent away for 3 days with before setting my finger put in a new enormous pot of salt. That hurts. And it didn't stop bleeding. After 20 years, some of the pieces of my finger came back. So apart from the fact that you learn from the outside to the inside, these small jobs, there are also these trick of the trades which you slowly learn. And from all the TV chefs there are, I can tell you the one who isn't a professional chef, and she's called Lawson, because she always grabs things this way. And all the others do it this way, but they're proper trained. So this enskillment is about attention education. It's about developing sophisticated perceptual awareness of the properties. A friend of mine was at a very young age engaged with iron melting. So you learn about various shades of the temperature by looking through a particular glass. And you learn, well, yeah, this is about right. And it's very difficult to get it right, but slowly it's attention to awareness. So you build up this slowly
this knowledge slowly, and you have this beat element of it. So it's a string of beats, and you build on from there. And it's all very much embodied. So you should know how to hold on your cue, as all the commentators with snooker tell you. Keep your head still. Okay, let me draw this second leg to a close. Zi, this is the Chinese notion of knowledge, is moral. It's moral wisdom realized in practice. It's knowing correctly what to do. You learn artisanal knowledge via immersion, and model emulation is learned via immersion. So my argument is that both artisanal knowledge and Zi deal with performative action. Both have at their core coping or behavioral routines, and both are non-cognitive. And both are a form of knowledge and a practice, so both are monistic. Okay, this gets me back to Zielsel. It took about, for all kinds of reasons, 9 years to publish the Zielsel essays he published in America. And after 9 years of looking at this text, I knew from every possible angle I could think of, it was clear to me that Zielsel, for Zielsel, all this to the emergence of modern science, which is basically experimental science, is the erosion of social barriers between artisans and the intellectuals. If they're brought down, these barriers, and hence the two strata, which is history, start conversing with one another, hey presto, we have modern science. And the mechanism behind this bringing up the barrier down is the emergence of capitalism in the city-states of Italy. Now, the problem that one can see with this argument is that it allows for the dissolution of social barriers between the different social strata. But what remains clear is how you get from here to science. Because, after all, we've seen that artisanal knowledge, which aims at producing new configuration of interlocking artifacts as a sustainable result, and scientific experimentation, as we know, aims to test explanatory principles of verified theory, where do the explanatory principles or truth, where does it come from? Now, the artisanal social result, the Marxist social dissolvement, doesn't get you from one to the other. So you talk about the pudding not in terms of truth, you talk about it in terms of eating. That's what the proof is. And if it's all right, it's all right. And I can tell you, you have excellent mousse, chocolate mousse at St. John's Chop House. Very good. But that's not truth, but the quality of what you get. So the problem then becomes, where are the scientific knowledge, where does it get its explanatory principles from? And now we go to this. And the answer, obviously, we all know this, comes from the Greek. So the Greek idea of what episteme is, I'll leave that untranslated for now, if that is through knowledge of things or situations through one or more causes, that's when you know things, or Aristotle put it, any intellectual knowledge deals with causes and principles. You have the famous quote by Plato from Theaetetus, and we do not have knowledge of a thing until we have grasped its why. That is to say, its cause is Aristotle at the beginning of his physics. Now, compared to artisanal knowledge way of learning, a number of differences immediately spring to mind. Artisanal knowledge involves the attunement of the body to an environment, cosmopolis, that's my term for nature, or the universe out there. Artisanal knowledge is embodied. The Greek notion of knowledge, because it's about causes, theoretical, or what amounts to the same thing as conceptual, because, but more importantly, it's dualistic. It's knowledge about something which the subject has. And it's conceptual because it's located in the Greek secret grotto of the mind. As such, it's intellectualistic by definition. Now, the test of artisanal knowledge is the making, and the test of conceptual knowledge is the lucidness and the conciseness of the oral or written account which one produces something what one has learned. Now, artisanal knowledge entertains a radically different relation to the cosmopolis than theoretical knowledge. It's an ontology of events, that's artisanal knowledge, versus one of principle, theoretical. For it forces it, and this itself forces it through the way one learns about it. The differences between the artisanal tradition, to know one has to act, and the other is to act, one has to know. Now you can see that the tradition between artisanal knowledge and the Chinese one is more or less the same. So now I have a fine question for if you have a paper on this topic. Without any subject-object distinction, there can be no scientific thinking. Discuss. The sinologist Julia Cheng, whom I'm quoting here, and who clearly knows a thing or two about Chinese philosophy, seems to be saying that the Western-style dualism is responsible for scientific thinking. A provocative suggestion, indeed. But from my presentation of the synthetic ideas about knowledge, you should be able to see why she's raising the question. Because there we have a monistic tradition, we have a dualistic tradition, and all of a sudden, this element of this dualism becomes important. Now, my reading of Julia Cheng's elliptic formulation is the following. The Ru aren't into truth, but they are devising a system of practical morality. And in a world practice that concentrates on acting righteously, truth doesn't come into play. It doesn't come into play because the cardinal Chinese idea of the sanguinity between man and nature and the monism it entails implies there is no higher level from which man or nature can be grasped. Grasped in a necessary abstract way, it is. Or to put it differently, epistemological worries have no room to live in a monistic model of knowledge. I'll skip the bit about Nathan Sivan, where I sort of calibrate what he's saying, or what I'm saying, with what he's arguing, and simply say, well, for fundamental reasons, in Chinese philosophy, there is missing this overarching idea of the need for theoretical explanation. And it's been many times observed that the Chinese are characterized by the absence of theoretical explanations. But more importantly, from my point of view, if that's true, the Nathan theism doesn't work. And it can't work for an obvious reason. You need two levers. You have only one lever in the Chinese tradition available, and that's where it gets difficult. Now we go to this one. I'm almost there. This should be Venice. We all know about a very particular formulation of a question that's in the Discorsi. And the opening phrase is here. And for me, this is the essence of the Zielsol thesis. Artisanal knowledge becomes in need of theoretical elucidation and justification. It isn't of itself. Can exist of itself, there is no need for it to be transformed into scientific knowledge, but all of a sudden at this time in history it is. And this, what it says here, is important. That leaves me with one thing. So where does this idea that nature is somehow cognitive accessible? So what's being said here is that why is the dimensions of stocks and scaffolding and bracing used to launch a bigger ship different from a small one? Now you can argue in different ways, but let me give you a home-based example. If you need a teaspoon of salt to cook 1 kg of potatoes, you don't need 10 kg of you don't need 10 teaspoons to cook 10 kg. And if you try it, you'll know it's horrible. So artisans are satisfied they're able to work out what to do, but natural philosophers aren't. And this is what Galileo tries to do. So that leaves me with one final line of reasoning. Where does this idea that nature is cognitive accessible come from? It isn't on the table in China, it isn't on the table in Islamic tradition, which I didn't talk about, but somehow in Latin Europe it is. And the answer is, it's Christian, Semitic to be precise, but let's keep it for Christian at the moment. Now, two things need to combine now. The readability, this is my translation of the German Lesbarkeit
which is used by Bloomberg in his book, of nature and its mathematical makeup. That's to say that the root of the metaphor of liber nature needs to be understood in conjunction with the metaphor of God as the superior artisan. The readability of the book of nature is an expression of the idea that the universe is an intelligible entity. Key to the maker's tradition of knowledge is the idea that the only reality with which an inquirer can have commerce is reality as construed it to be. And to put it in a way that's formulated later, verum esse ipsum factum, truth is what it's made. Now, nature is readable because God created it. And this is a slide where Kepler tries to put exactly that idea. Now, probably the most famous line of Schoenbus, De Revue Schoenbus, is this one. Now, all the stress is all the time on, where is it? The propter nos, this one. But for my argument, much more important is this, that all the time Copernicus expresses this idea that God, of God in the Revue Schoenbus, it's in terms of the opifix, so the artisan or the manufacturer. So apart from the quote I just gave, these are all the other ones. And the last one was the one that had to be crossed out because of it being on the list of prohibited books. So we have, if we combine this with the Platonic idea that no one be ignorant of geometry enter here, which is on the title page, the inference has to be for Copernicus, Deus is an artificer, an architect, a mathematical artisan who created the world with mathematical principles in mind. In the maker's conception of knowledge, making implies knowing. With Copernicus, we have made along mathematical lines implies knowing in mathematical terms. Mathematics is the key to understanding the world created for us. Okay, one final page. I have been banging on how you learn all the time, but why? In an entertaining argument, an illuminating argument between Adrian John, former student of the HBS department, and Elizabeth Eisenstein over the place of the history of books in the history of Europe, Eisenstein points out that her interest in the history of books is really because she thinks it tells you something about Europe as a civilization. Now you have Adrian's response as follows. Western civilization is by the standards of those who beaver away in archives a stratosphere. So, where would you start looking for it? Wonderful quote. I congratulated Adrian on it because I needed it. Good question. Now, I can tell you where I would start as an anthropologist. I started learning. That's why I've been banging on about learning all the time. More precise, I start about meta-strategies of learning. So not just what you learn, but how you learn. Now if you do this, something comes very obvious. And the obvious reason why you start, as in the book, start about learning is because culture comes from learning. Put it more crudely, you're born without culture, all of a sudden you have it somewhere, you pick it up. Learning must be a connection. So to develop an anthropological theory on this abstruse notion of civilization, I suggest you start looking at how you learn, how learning is done, and make that central to the theory of cultural differences. If you do that, you automatically have insight that the dominant strategy of learning in the Sinetic tradition is model emulation, what I started with. It's route learning, so learning by heart in the Islamic tradition, and it's conceptual elucidation in the Greek or Christian tradition, conceptual elucidation, what I'm trying to do now. You can also say it's preaching. The only question that remains then is why are the learning strategies different? And why do the three civilizations have three different green sciences? That's history for China, that's jurisprudence for Islam, and that's theology for Latin Europe. And the suggestion entertained in the book is to make these meta-strategies of learning central to an anthropological theory of civilization. And I've just shown you the contours how to apply this theory to the needful question. And thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.